Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 94, but who's counting? It's Monday, December 28th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Here we are at your People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Of course, COVID-19 continues to dominate the public health news. And the big story, perhaps for this year, maybe next year, certainly for months, is the new UK variant, which could change the course of this epidemic. So let's start with a story about that. What kind of questions are raised by this variant, this mutation, arising that's more infectious? This from Stat News. The looming question scientists need to answer about the new variant of the coronavirus. A variant of the coronavirus that emerged in the United Kingdom has forced London to shut down, led some countries to ban travel to and from the UK, and set off a global manhunt to find out where else this version has arrived. So what comes next? Whenever a potentially significant viral variant emerges, experts want to study its effects on three key factors: how well it spreads, the disease it causes, and whether it can evade the protection people have against the pathogen, either because they've been infected already or are vaccinated against it. Scientists have started to figure out the answer to the first. Many increasingly think that this variant is more transmissible, though some are holding out for more evidence. And so far, it doesn't seem to affect how sick people get. As for immunity, experts are racing to answer that question and to ensure that the vaccines that are just reaching people are maintaining their effectiveness. It's obviously associated with a lot of uncertainty at this point, said Christian Anderson, an infectious disease expert at Scripps Research Institute. Is immunity intact? As of now, there is no evidence that the virus has changed enough to get around existing immune protection. But experts say it's crucial to confirm that because the variant has a number and array of mutations unlike other versions of the virus that have popped up throughout the pandemic. We shouldn't just trust our priors and would be like, no, the virus wouldn't evolve this immune evasion, Anderson told Stat. The constellation of changes this variant has is, quote, really unusual, he said. Anderson added that he wasn't predicting there would necessarily be some impact on the effectiveness of vaccines, but stress that the studies, which are already underway in the UK, can address that. The studies involve pulling antibodies from the blood of people who have either recovered from COVID-19 or have been immunized and, in lab experiments, testing whether they still neutralize the variant. Coronavirus evolves more slowly than viruses like flu, but they do pick up mutations as they spread. SARS-CoV-2 has been adding one or two changes a month to its RNA genome since it emerged late last year in China. And different versions of the virus have been continuously circulating throughout the course of the pandemic. But this variant, referred to as B117 or VUI2020-12-1, showed up with at least 17 mutations, according to one genetic analysis. Some are in the stretch of the genome with the instruction for the virus's spike protein, which binds to human cells and enables the virus to infect them. The leading vaccines were designed to teach the immune system to make antibodies that can recognize and block the spike proteins. So it's possible that changes to the spike could alter how well the vaccines work. The same would occur with antibodies generated by an initial case of COVID-19, Wendy Barclay, the head of infectious diseases at Imperial College London, said. There's a chance that antibodies that were made in the first infection won't work as well against the new variant, she added. But Barclay stressed that the immune system has other components that contribute to protection, including fighters called T cells, which can also recognize the virus. And she noticed that vaccines elicit antibodies that can hone in on different parts of the spike protein and that take different approaches to fighting off the virus. So even if some lost their ability to target the spike, the vaccines have other ways to block the virus. It would be unlikely that these changes in the variant would overcome all of those layers. Plus, if the virus were evolved to escape vaccines now or at some point in the future, it most likely wouldn't render the immunizations ineffective entirely. It would just make them less protective, and they would need to be updated. It's possible, Barclay said, the vaccines could be compromised to some extent, and that's what we need to check out. Because the vast majority of the world remains susceptible to the virus, there hasn't been much evolutionary pressure on the virus to adapt, though that will change as a greater proportion of the population gets vaccinated. But in this case, experts think B.1.1.7 didn't evolve through the normal pattern of slowly incorporating mutations into its genome as it copied itself as it spread. Instead, they say it's possible that an immunocompromised person who had a rare chronic case of COVID-19, whose long-lasting infection would have let the virus replicate for weeks or longer, building up mutations rapidly, could be the source of the new variant and has since spread to others. Does it make people sicker? Researchers also are investigating whether the variant B.1.1.7 has any impact, for good or bad, on how sick it makes people, though so far the mutations only seem to have affected transmissibility, not pathogenicity, that is, how the virus causes disease. Experts in the UK are reviewing the rates at which people with the variant are hospitalized and how long they stay, as well as deaths. It's early days, so as people know, both hospital admissions and mortality are lagging indicators, usually taking 2 to 4 weeks to see, said Susan Hopkins, an epidemiologist at Public Health England. I think we'll be very cautious until we've had enough time to be able to make accurate assessments. Does it spread more easily? All viruses mutate, and researchers have been looking out for potentially concerning SARS-2 variants for months. Already, one variant known as D614G helped increase the efficiency at which the virus spreads, most researchers agree. But other mutations have raised alarms at times that have turned out to be duds. Mutations occur all the time, and they can help the virus spread or sicken or detract from that. Many don't have any effect at all. Some forms of the virus emerge and then disappear. British researchers and public officials have said B.1.1.7 is more transmissible than other versions of the coronavirus, with estimates ranging from 50% to 70% more infectious. But some scientists still want more evidence. It's possible, for example, that a variant can look more contagious if it just happens to gain a toehold in an area first so it has the most room to run, or is the beneficiary of a couple pivotal superspreading events. But multiple research teams have arrived at the same finding, that B.1.1.7 is spreading more efficiently than other strains, based on epidemiological and genetic analyses. We now have high confidence that this variant does have a transmission advantage over other virus variants that are currently in the UK. Peter Horby, an infectious disease expert at the University of Oxford, said, upgrading his assessment from the previous week of moderate confidence, the variant is continuing to overtake other forms of SARS-2 in the country, scientists said. There are various estimates of what that increase in transmission means, but researchers say the new variant could have increased the reproduction number, a figure known as R0, which is the average of how many people one person will infect, from 1.1 to 1.5. That is a big difference. With the former, 10 infected people on average would lead to 11 new infections, but with the latter, the 10 people would cause 15 new infections, a difference that would balloon from there as those secondary cases cause new infections themselves. R0 can be lowered with interventions like masking and physical distancing. Epidemics will grow if the figure is above 1 and shrink if it's brought below 1. Experts aren't sure yet what about B.1.1.7 appears to help it spread more easily. They've noticed that people with this version tend to have higher levels of virus in their upper airways than other people with COVID-19, so it's possible more virus is being shed. Perhaps people are infectious sooner after they become infected themselves. One of the mutations, called N501Y, has been shown to help the virus latch on better to receptor it uses to infect cells, called ACE2. Another mutation affects what's known as the virus's furin cleavage site, which helps the virus center cells as it attaches to them. These differences provide what Barclay called biological plausibility for the variant being a better spreader. Indeed, researchers reported that a separate variant spotted in South Africa that shares at least one mutation with the UK strain, N501Y, also has higher transmission rates. British researchers also raise another point of concern about the new variant. It might be able to infect children at higher rates than other versions. One of the saving graces of the pandemic is that SARS-2 has not been infecting children at the rate of adults and has generally not made them nearly as sick. Hypothesis for this is that kids don't have as many ACE2 receptors on their cells compared to adults. But in the UK, epidemiologists are finding that more infections among children are caused by the new variant compared to other versions. They're trying to determine the significance of the pattern, but it's possible that if the variant is better at latching onto ACE2 than other strains, it doesn't need as many of the receptors to establish an infection. If the virus is having an easier time of binding and entering cells, then that would put children on a more level playing field, Barclay said. It sort of overcomes one of those barriers that the virus was meeting before. Already, at least one case of B117 has been confirmed, each in the Netherlands, Denmark, Italy, Iceland, and Australia. But experts have noted it's the places that sequence the most viral samples from people who are infected that are reporting the variant. In other words, if countries look for it, they may find it. It is very likely that it has emerged here, Hopkins said, referring to the UK. However, it's very likely that it's also in other countries because there's been transport back and forth between many European countries for the last 3 months. The British researchers first noticed the apparent transmission advantage of B117 this month, but after that, they looked back through sequencing data and found that the variant first appeared in September. One country that does not have a coordinated sequencing system is the United States. Some research institutions have been studying genetic data and submitting them to a national database, but there's not a federal effort to ensure the viral samples are being collected and sequenced from groups of patients in a way that's representative of geography and demographics. As late as this summer, for example, there was no sequencing information from any patients in Pennsylvania in the database, one expert told Stat. There was a rather random assortment of sequences, said Diane Griffin, a virologist at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, who chaired a committee for the National Academy of Sciences about genomic epidemiology for SARS-2. Despite the concern about the new variant, experts reiterated that the same public health measures preached since the early days of the pandemic would still combat its spread. Mike Ryan, the head of the World Health Organization's Emergencies Program, noted that the R-naught in certain places has far exceeded 1.5 at various times, that the virus was still brought under control. In some senses, it means we have to work harder, Ryan said. World Health Organization officials also noted that reducing transmission cuts the possibility of dangerous variants emerging. The bottom line is that we need to suppress transmission of all SARS-CoV-2 viruses as quickly as we can, said the World Health Organization Director General. The more we allow it to spread, the more opportunity it has to change. Now, this is a good overview of the different questions that need to be raised. Our own Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has stated that they believe that this is up to 70% more infectious, which, of course, I think this could be a game changer, because not only does it mean you'll get more infections, it also changes the proportion of the population that you need in order to guarantee herd immunity, which is basically the number of people that are protected from infection or infectiousness that can basically herd or isolate the virus and keep it from spreading to other people. So while this might have been 75%, 80%, you know, if you get something that's a third or 70% more infectious, this could jump up into the 80%, even 90%, which make it much more harder, meaning that those last 10, 15, or 20% of people in the population that you need to immunize are a lot harder to immunize than the first few people. So I think the bottom line is this is something that's going to have to be contended with, even if it's only infectiousness and none of these other things swing the way that would be more dangerous. So hopefully we can deal with it well.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you. at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, as many have noted, the worst is ahead of us as far as the COVID-19 pandemic. And the next story we want to do is giving a perspective from the front lines, this from Stat News. A Duty to Warn, an ER doctor shaped by war and hardship, chronicles the searing realities of COVID-19. As a combat medic deployed in the Marines in Iraq al-Anbar province, Cleavon Gilman saw bodies torn apart by IEDs. He heard agonizing screams, saw burned flesh, and penetrating trauma. He stood in pools of blood, tending to fellow Marines with severed spinal cords, missing limbs, and intestines bulging through gaping wounds. He emptied the pockets of the dead, collecting baby pictures and ultrasound photos, removed dog tags, and stacked bodies, sometimes two or three at a time, into refrigerated trailers. He still has PTSD, though he returned from the war 16 years ago. Even so, that experience did not prepare him for the coronavirus. Seeing this kind of death is not normal, said Gilman, an emergency room physician who cared for an onslaught of COVID-19 patients in New York as the virus killed 20,000 people over a matter of weeks this spring. He's now working in a second hotspot, Yuma, Arizona, which has nearly four times the nation's rate of new coronavirus cases per capita, a major outbreak in its prison, and a hospital overflowing with patients. I've trained for this. I've been in war, and this is absolutely worse, Gilman said. There are no borders in this war. There is no date when I know I'm going home. You may have pandemic fatigue, but Gilman is flat out exhausted. Whether it was this spring in New York Presbyterian Hospital, when choruses of ambulances sirens pierced the night, or his current work in rural Arizona, where he often struggles to find an open ICU bed. He treated COVID patients for 10 solid months. And as he sweats to save the lives of the farm workers, prison guards, and snowbirds who are his patients, he's fighting what may be an even harder battle to persuade people in a state, including a governor who refuses to order a mask mandate, to take the virus seriously. After you treat patients, intubate them, see people watch their loved ones die, you get to drive home past the gym that's crowded with people, past the people who are eating at restaurants inside maskless, he said. It's just a slap in the face over and over again. At first through a daily diary of Facebook posts, and now through a relentless Twitter stream and almost 100,000 followers, Gilman has emerged as a vocal leader speaking out on behalf of healthcare workers and a voice of outrage railing against the virus's steep toll and the politicians who aren't working harder to contain it. It's a surprising platform for a man who dropped out of high school because he was teased mercilessly for a crippling speech impediment and who escaped a grim upbringing to become a physician trained at some of the nation's most elite institutions. The voice got him into trouble late last month after he sent out a tweet about the lack of ICU beds in Arizona. He was fired, he said, despite severe staff shortages at the hospital, Yuma Regional Medical Center. I've been sidelined for 3 weeks while many of my colleagues have been ill, he told staff. I've been risking my life here since July, and for this to happen is inexcusable. Once it became public, Gilman's apparent dismissal provoked outrage on social media from both Yuma residents and physicians around the nation. Even Oprah chimed in to offer Gilman and his family an all-expense-paid vacation for his service. Afterward, the hospital released a statement saying Gilman had not been fired, and his not being scheduled to work was a, quote, misunderstanding. News to me, Gilman said, but the coronavirus was still burning through Yuma. More than 650 new cases of inmates had surfaced in recent weeks at the state prison complex in town. When the hospital called last week, Gilman suited up and returned to work. It was in New York that Gilman started chronicling what he saw in the nation's first coronavirus epicenter, on social media and on his own website. At first, he was posting to keep track of his experiences as a chief resident at the New York Presbyterian, something he'd regretted not doing when he was at war. He wrote after each shift in the emergency department, exhausted and sometimes through tears, about the barbers, nannies, construction workers, bartenders, waitresses, and store clerks he was trying to keep alive. He wrote about patients' gratitude when he'd bring them a cup of water, that he tried to treat them like family. They are Black, Dominican, Puerto Rican, and Mexican, he wrote. A lot of them don't have enough money to pay for a subway ride home for the hospital. Quickly, his purpose shifted. I really wanted to warn people, he says now. At this rate of intubations, we're going to run out of ventilators, he wrote in a post on March 20th. 2 nights later, when the city recorded 6,211 cases, he took a moment to look around as 80 patients waited for admission. I guess this is what a pandemic will look like, he wrote. The onslaught of coronavirus patients at the hospital was so difficult, even veteran doctors were shaken. I worked 9/11, the anthrax attacks in New York City, SARS, Ebola, and Hurricane Sandy. But this was different, said Renu Chawa Mittal, the senior associate attending physician who supervised Gilman at New York Presbyterian. During the 9/11 attacks, we tried to save as many patients as possible, but we were not putting our own lives at risk. With this, not only did we have an overwhelming number of patients infected, we saw our own colleagues falling down before our eyes. The fear and anxiety was real. Gilman was still in New York when Arizona's rising caseload and a lack of precautions riled him up. He'd chosen a job in Yuma after completing his residency because it was close to California and would allow him to work in a medically underserved community and be paid well enough to help him start to chip away at his hefty medical school debt. But he was worried. He was leaving a city that had dramatically curbed the spread of the virus and moving to a state where businesses were reopening and the governor, Doug Ducey, refused to issue a statewide mask mandate. He knew doctors were supposed to stay in their lane. He knew senior physicians who had been disciplined or lost their jobs for speaking out. He didn't care. Governor Ducey, if you don't mandate face masks when people will not wear them, he tweeted mid-June, it's time to lead. When Ducey hosted a largely maskless rally for President Trump on June 23rd, Gilman went apoplectic. Looks like a super spreader event by our super spreader commander-in-chief, he wrote. I'm right out of the frying pan of hashtag New York into the fire of hashtag Arizona, he tweeted a week before his first ER shift in Yuma in mid-July. We must keep being vocal. Gilman kept up a steady stream of commentary, warning about the rise in cases in Arizona, the lack of resources, the many, many young people suffering from COVID in his ER, and the need to wear masks and ban large gatherings. While he no longer faces the crush of patients he saw in New York because Yuma's population is under 100,000, Gilman said conditions in some ways are harder. In New York, there were so many resources, doctors and nurses, you could make whole intubation teams, he said. Here, it's the exact opposite. And because there are so few restrictions on activities, his ER is still shouldering a full load of regular emergencies, even as new coronavirus patients arrive day after day. In New York, everyone stayed home, so we're not having car accidents and trauma, he said. Today, a patient came in for hemorrhoids, and I said, are you kidding me right now? Why are you here? This is not an emergency. Sometimes out of beds to handle the influx of new COVID patients, Gilman said he had to resort to treating patients in the ER waiting room. You can't move patients out of the ER because there's no room upstairs, and you can't move people from upstairs because there are no ICU beds, he said. With COVID patients, ICU beds only open when someone dies. While a mask mandate narrowly passed in his county, he remained stunned at the governor's refusal to issue stay-at-home orders or statewide mask mandate. He's been staying away from crowds, getting takeout only, and not seeing family. Meanwhile, in Phoenix, a massive soccer tournament that included more than 400 out-of-state teams was played over Thanksgiving. That cannot be allowed to happen when I can't find an ICU bed, he said. That threw me off the edge. More recently, Gilman had been using his platform to amplify the plight of healthcare workers who are penalized for speaking out and to highlight the deaths of young, previously healthy patients who were killed by the virus. One of those was his own cousin, Simon Press, a 27-year-old who was trying out for the NFL, who died on December 7th. Press had been sent home from his local ER in New Jersey twice, Gilman said, after being told his chest pains were just anxiety. He wasn't swabbed for the virus until he reached the coroner's office. For now, Gilman is happy to be back in the ER, where he returned last week. The first patient he saw asked whether he was the doctor who'd been in the paper and thanked him for staying. He has every intention, he said, of continuing his personal deployment against the virus. and continuing to speak out. We should not be silencing the voices of healthcare workers, he said. I feel a duty to warn people. There you go, folks. You have been warned. Spread the word, not the virus. Okay, well, let's get to the local update. It's getting hard to report on the cases because testing is kind of messing with the holidays and such. So it's hard to interpret what the tests mean. Fortunately, I guess, the average number of cases in a day, the seven-day average, was 247 most recently. And that's a slight drop from 275 the previous week and quite a big drop from earlier weeks. But with testing going down, it's kind of hard to say if this reflects the actual pandemic. As I've calculated in previous weeks, I took the most two recent weeks of data on both positive tests and total number of tests done. And of course, the positivity rate was ridiculously high at 79%. And of course, in previous weeks, it had been 82%, 74%, way up. They're kind of pinning out because negative tests are just not being reported with any speed. So I finally got sick of that, having to report on the same thing week after week after week. So I actually went back and I took 8 weeks of testing data. So I'm assuming after a month or two that you can largely catch up on the total number of tests. And also, I know the state is getting data, I think better data, on the total number of tests and the positivity rate. But for some reason, locally, we're not able to get that reported. Okay, so I took 8 weeks of data from November 2nd to today, and the positivity rate over that 8 week period combined was 38.7%. That is ridiculously high. Now, it might be a slight overestimate because maybe there's still, you know, 5 or 10,000, who knows, 15,000 tests that aren't reported, but this is over 40,000 tests over this 8 week period. Okay, in Ohio, which I think has better data, but I'm not entirely sure. The good news is that our testing positivity rate has moved down to 13% from last week when I reported 13.9%. This is still ridiculously high, but it is going in the right direction. But of course, the thing that's confused is that this actually is statewide is the lowest weekly testing volume since October. So we are testing fewer people. And of course, you test fewer people, you're going to identify fewer people. So it's hard to really tease out because our surveillance system kind of has some holes punched through it to know how accurately it's actually reflecting the underlying epidemic. And even though we're testing less locally, the amount of time it takes for a positive test result to be returned is still 4.5 days, which is about as high as it's been recently. And this is even with the total numbers of tests perform trending down. Now, maybe some of this has to do with the holiday, but this has been an ongoing chronic problem. Okay, one place where we do have a little more regular program of testing is in nursing homes, long-term care facilities. And the number of active cases there set a new record. It's been around 200 the last several weeks. We went from 190 2 weeks ago to 207 last week to 214 this most recent week. So that's still plugging along. Here, the most recent testing positivity rate that we had was 19.9%, but those were already supposed to be updated by now, and they were not as of today, right at the recording of the show, live. We don't have it. So apparently there's some problems, again, punching holes in the surveillance data. We have capacity issues as far as even being able to report data that I think is out there, but somebody's job is either on vacation or they're being pulled to do something else. Who knows? Okay. Well, another lagging indicator, but the ultimate bad indicator is deaths. And we are seeing the Lucas County death rate increasing. And the death rate in Lucas County is well above the state and national rate. It's 55% higher than the state death rate and 31% higher than the national death rate. We've had a total of 58 deaths in the last 14 days. And last week on the show, I reported 52 deaths. Okay. I got another batch of the Federal Department of Health and Human Services hospitalization data for Lucas County. But like some other data problems, it seems to be a theme here. There was missing data, and it looked inconsistent. So I'm not really able to report on it. I'm waiting. Hopefully that'll sort itself out over time. Okay, well, and UT and Lucas County Schools are still reporting some, but they're, of course, out of class. So it's kind of hard to interpret what those numbers, so I'll just pass on that. But we do have some new data that we just started reporting last week, brand new. The Ohio Department of Health is now reporting the number of vaccines started. We don't have completed vaccines because people have to get a second dose, which hasn't happened yet. But in Ohio, we've had 52,920 people vaccinated. That is 0.45% of the population. In Lucas County, we've had 2,815 people vaccinated as of reported today, and that's 0.66% of the population. So, hey, go Lucas County. We're doing a little bit better relative to the state as a whole in getting people vaccinated. But we know that there was at least 98,000 doses of vaccine that were here a week and a half ago. So it looks like we haven't even been able to get into the arms half of the doses that we've got, and that could be somewhat of a problem. Like I've reported before, getting the vaccines that actually are produced into the arms of people is difficult, and apparently it's difficult even doing it in those first people who are literally working every day in healthcare facilities, whether it be a hospital or a long-term care facility. Okay, well, on that note, this next story from Stat News. Beware the danger of vaccine euphoria. The advent of COVID-19 vaccines is a medical miracle, yet also a tantalizing and dangerous psychological milestone. It's not the beginning of the end of the pandemic, but more likely the end of the beginning, to borrow a phrase from Winston Churchill. The first day of distribution of vaccine in the United States illustrated the point. California accepted its initial delivery of 33,150 doses just as it was beginning to average more than that number of new coronavirus cases every day. Such realities, though grim, have been easy to overlook. Exuberant headlines about vaccines, now 2 million more doses, have grabbed attention, as have rightfully joyous social media photos of healthcare workers receiving their inoculations. We get so kind of blinded by vaccine euphoria, the light at the end of the tunnel, that we underestimate how long the tunnel is and how dangerous that tunnel is, said Peter Sands, executive director of the Swiss-based Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, which has expanded its mission to combat COVID. For most of the countries the fund invests in, Sands added at a recent health summit hosted at the Milken Institute, vaccines are not going to be available at scale until late 21 at the earliest, and a lot of lives are going to be lost in that in-between time. So hand washing, mask wearing, social distancing, and experts warn a healthy new dose of cognitive dissonance will continue to be the daily reality for most of us for months to come. The question is whether Americans will get too caught up in the enthusiasm over what they perceive to be elixirs nearly at hand. Perhaps they might wonder, can't they let their guards down just a little? William Hallman, a psychologist at Rutgers University and an expert in the study of the perception of risk, noted that the statistical risk of any given activity matters far less than what you think the risk is. So from a risk perception standpoint, he said, there is a potential danger that people will now get vaccinated and think they are superhuman and nothing can touch them, which is certainly not true. Not only do the vaccines not prevent 100% of infections, it's still unclear whether they prevent infection and transmission of the virus that causes the disease, leaving the unvaccinated vulnerable. Health workers who are vaccinated will most likely follow public health guidance to continue wearing masks in public. But what of the rest of us? Hallman, who chairs the Department of Human Ecology at Rutgers, said that one of his frustrations as a psychologist is that the national messaging about the pandemic has been led most vocally, and perhaps understandably, by physicians and epidemiologists, and their focus on the germ and what to do about it. By contrast, he said, there have been very few social scientists, behavioral scientists, in helping the government determine how to change people's behavior. I would beg to differ a little bit editorially that I think there's a lot of epidemiologists and infectious disease experts that deal with a lot of social science. But back to the story. If I get vaccinated and decide I don't want to wear a mask anymore and can go to the grocery store, what's the proper response from a grocery store manager? Hallman said his proposed message to public officials would be brutally clear. This is what we know. This is how we know it. There's still some things we don't know. Here's what's important. Here's what we're going to become a lot more certain about. Here's what we think we should do now. There are also a matter of just There's also the matter of just how long it's going to take to distribute enough vaccine for all of those who want it. Many potential impediments remain in getting the vaccine from pharmaceutical laboratories and warehouses into the biceps of Americans, starting with the challenges of mass production. There's an old saying, the hardest part of making vaccines is making vaccines, said Paul Offit, professor of pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a member of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. He noted the storage and shipment requirements for the only vaccine authorized so far are cumbersome, particularly for the vaccine developed by Pfizer. That could make distribution more difficult, even as supply expands. Both require two doses for full effect. Itself a logistical and messaging challenge in getting those vaccinated to complete the full course. And there will be spurious safety questions, Offit added. My grandmother got the vaccine and 2 days later she had a stroke or heart attack. So the virus causes strokes or heart attacks. You're going to be dealing with a lot of that. Samantha Penta, an associate professor of emergency preparedness at SUNY Albany, noted that there is also always some segment of the population unable to tolerate vaccines because of allergies or because they are immunocompromised. Taken together, such caveats guarantee that just because a vaccine is out doesn't mean that a sufficient proportion of the country is protected to mean that the virus is still not spreading. So far, any serious side effects of inoculations have been comparatively isolated and easily managed. But the vaccines have yet to be tested on children or those who are pregnant or lactating, for example. Penta said that it's really important for people to keep in mind that while the vaccine is a great step and great progress toward a future in which we don't have to worry about COVID-19, it's really hundreds of thousands of little steps that are going to take a long time. Much of the next few months, for a lot of people, are going to look and feel very similar to the past few months. Robert Marshall, a cardiologist in Washington, D.C., said healthcare workers remain exquisitely sensitive about maintaining vigilance and not letting their guard down at this point, and that doctors and the public alike should use the vaccine as motivation to go strong and beat COVID fatigue. As interventional cardiologists, he warned, we have to continue to assume every patient is potentially infectious, regardless of whether they have symptoms. This is especially true with heart attack victims, given it is a known consequence of COVID. Many of these patients need an immediate procedure, and there's no time for the PCR test. In most cases, not even a rapid test to be back in time before rushing off to the cardiac catheterization lab. We therefore don the full protective gear, not only to protect ourselves, but for those who we may come in contact with who may be more vulnerable. We will not change this approach anytime soon, and the same case should be made to the public. Okay, next up from Stat News. COVID-19 vaccines are safe, but let's be clear about what safe means. Unprecedented collaborative efforts in vaccine developments have culminated in multiple vaccines being tested in advanced clinical trials, all in less than 1 year since global leaders understood we were in the midst of a global pandemic. One is now being given to healthcare workers, and another will soon follow. As the first COVID-19 vaccines are being distributed in the United States and in other countries around the world, the main question now on many minds is, are these vaccines safe? The answer is yes. Vaccines are one of the great modern triumphs of public health. They've helped add several decades of human life expectancy and are one of the best tools for preventing disease, debilitation, and death. Immunizations with childhood vaccines prevent 2 to 3 million deaths every year. They are also one of the most thoroughly tested and safest products in history. We know from recently completed clinical trials of the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines for COVID-19 that serious reactions are rare. And as these vaccines are deployed to millions, we will gain even greater confidence in their safety and effectiveness via post-marketing studies. However, it's important to be clear about what safe means. No vaccine, indeed no medical treatment, is completely free from side effects, and it is the responsibility of medical professionals to be honest about them so people are prepared and more likely to trust the science. Skepticism about vaccines has existed since Edward Jenner first immunized an 8-year-old boy against smallpox in 1796. The reasons vary from religious beliefs to centuries of medical exploitation inflicted on communities of color and to rampant misinformation on social media. On top of these, COVID-19 vaccines are being developed, tested, and approved at record speeds. Before a vaccine is approved for use by the general public, it must go through a careful process in which it is tested in tens of thousands of volunteers. The system is set up to catch all but the rarest of side effects. Even after a vaccine is licensed, it is subject to stringent safety assessments to detect problems that arise when a vaccine is given to millions of people. All of that complicates the ability of public health leaders to communicate that side effects and adverse reactions to the vaccine are normal, especially when such reactions become headlines, are amplified on social media, and become fodder for conspiracy theories. In 2009, for example, the H1N1 vaccine, also known as the swine flu vaccine, was associated with an extremely small risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome, a rare autoimmune disease that caused nerve damage. Researchers calculated there were 1.6 extra cases of the syndrome among every 1 million people vaccinated. At the time, the CDC made clear communication a priority, holding near daily briefings about the country's vaccination campaign as a way to ease public concerns about the vaccine safety. The U.S. had learned its lesson the hard way. In 1976, an overwrought response to a small, contained swine flu outbreak led to many false stories about the side effects of a then newly developed swine flu vaccine. In other cases, experts have determined that the risks of a particular vaccine were too costly to bear. Take RotaShield, the first vaccine developed to prevent rotavirus, a serious gastrointestinal disease in children. The vaccine was licensed in the U.S. in 1998. A year later, an investigation showed that the vaccine increased the risk of a rare intestinal obstruction by 1 to 2 cases per 10,000 infants vaccinated. Vaccinations were halted, and the manufacturer pulled the vaccine from the market. This experience demonstrates the rigor of America's vaccine safety and oversight process, and how quickly authorities act if there is a problem. Second-generation rotavirus vaccines were later licensed and deployed, and post-marketing safety evaluations found no increases in risk of intestinal obstruction. To be sure, experience in any adverse effect or developing a disease from a vaccine, something that's supposed to prevent disease, can be devastating for individuals and families and should never be taken lightly, even amid a global pandemic. But the overwhelming benefits of vaccines to individuals and society significantly outweigh the risk for adverse reactions. Thanks to vaccines that make it through the stringent system of testing and approval, infectious diseases that once affected hundreds of thousands of people per year in the U.S. are now exceedingly rare, or in cases like smallpox, polio, and rubella, are fully eradicated. The downside is that once a disease is kept at bay by vaccination, we tend to let our guard down and lose sight of how crucial vaccines are to keeping them that way. COVID-19 is yet another example in which the risk of not being vaccinated is far greater than the risk of side effects posed by the vaccine itself. Of the tens of thousands of people who have already been vaccinated, some have reported short-term symptoms like fevers or aches, and a few have reported allergic reactions. Compare that to the virus itself, which has infected more than 70 million people globally and killed approximately 1.6 million people. That's to say nothing of the devastation caused to economies and health systems around the world. As the old adage goes, vaccines don't save lives, vaccinations do. The only way to put a stop to this ongoing tragedy and get back to some semblance of normal is to have widespread vaccination campaigns. That starts with helping people understand, through regular public briefings and mass media campaigns, that the COVID-19 vaccines are safe while being clear about potential side effects. It also requires complete ongoing transparency by national, state, and local government and public health officials as more data on these vaccines accumulate. Only then will we begin to rebuild trust, achieve widespread immunization, and ensure that this virus survives only in our history books. Okay, well, there you have it. A nice overview of what it means to be safe. I would add that these vaccines, I think particularly the Moderna vaccine after its second dose, has been shown to have a fairly high rate of, you know, sore arm, fatigue, fever for a day or maybe even two, even to the point where some people might miss a day of work or something. So they're not insignificant side effects, but this is actually the body reacting. But this is why the second dose, you've been primed with the first dose, and the second induces an even stronger reaction to get the fuller immunity. This is your body working, and even though it's, you know, it's an adverse event in the sense that, you know, nobody wants to be fatigued or have these symptoms, it's a much smaller hurdle to go over than having millions and millions of Americans infected with the virus and open to the full effects of the disease. We hit a home run, I think, with these first coming out with a 95% efficacy in avoiding severe disease. That is wonderful. And hopefully the data that's followed up when we get into millions and millions of people will show a similar level of efficacy, and we won't discover some really rare serious side effects. Okay, well, as most Americans know, vaccines are actually mandated in a variety of settings, sometimes by employers, oftentimes by schools for children, in order to ensure that the general population, through the gateways of specific populations like schools, you're reaching the herd level levels of immunity. But there isn't a whole lot of talk about COVID-19 being mandated. Although as we go along, if we're not able to get close to herd immunity levels, then it raises the question of what additional efforts we need to do in order to protect the entire population. So this is an important story from the New York Times. Employers can require workers to get COVID-19 vaccine, U.S. says. Doesn't mean they'll do it, but it's possible. Employers can require workers to get a COVID-19 vaccine and bar them from the workplace if they refuse, the federal government said in guidelines issued last week. Public health experts see employers as playing an important role in vaccinating enough people to reach herd immunity and get a handle on a pandemic that has killed more than 300,000 Americans. Widespread coronavirus vaccinations would keep people from dying, restart the economy, and usher return to some form of normalcy, experts say. Employers have been waiting for guidance from the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the agency that enforces laws against workplace discrimination, because requiring employees to be tested for the coronavirus touches on thorny medical and privacy issues covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. The guidance confirmed what employment lawyers had expected. Businesses and employers are uniquely positioned to require large numbers of Americans who otherwise would not receive a vaccination to do so because their employment depends on it. The Disabilities Act limits employers' ability to require medical examinations like blood tests, breath analyses, and blood pressure screening. These are procedures or tests often given in medical setting that seek information about employees' physical or mental conditions. The administration of a COVID-19 vaccine to a worker by an employer doesn't fit that definition, the commission said. If a vaccine is administered to an employee by an employer for protection against contracting COVID-19, the employer is not seeking information about an individual's impairments or current health status, it stated, and therefore it is not a medical examination. On its website, the commission said that requiring an employee to show proof of having gotten a COVID-19 vaccination would not amount to a disability-related inquiry. There are many reasons that may explain why an employee has not been vaccinated, which may or not be disability-related, the commission said. Even so, employers may need to be careful about how they handle the process. Pre-screening vaccination questions could violate an ADA, American Disabilities Act, provision on disability-related inquiries. Employers administering vaccines, the guidance said, must show that pre-screening questions are job-related and consistent with business necessity. Okay, well, this raises a very basic principle in public health and in law, that when you have an intervention, that it's like the least restrictive. So that's kind of what I was saying in the intro, is if through voluntary measures you can get herd immunity, well, go with that if you can. But you have to look at the different scenarios and the costs involved, the timelines, all of that, and weigh how much having different requirements, in this case, like for employees and employers, to actually require that it be part of a particular employment or work site setting. And I guess as a final note to that, early in these vaccination process, there have been people that have been pretty hesitant when you have the means to sign up to get a vaccine and you're getting, you know, half the people in, you know, a hospital setting or a long-term care facility that are not signing up, a indicator of hesitancy or not a powerful desire to be the first in line, that even in these settings where being vaccinated is particularly important, they may actually be the first workplaces where you would have such a requirement. Of course, I think this is largely a time thing. I can understand people wanting to have another 2 or 3, 4 months or whatever of experience of this going into millions of people's arms, and we'll have that, I guess, soon enough. But I personally would be happy to get a vaccine today. I'd be happy to vaccinate my daughter and my loved ones. My daughter's high risk, so I would double prefer that. So bring it on, as far as I'm concerned. In fact, I was thinking the other day, if I'd been given the opportunity to be in one of the vaccine clinical trials, I would have been delighted to do that as well. I am actually part of a cancer study. All I had to do is fill out a bunch of questionnaires and get my blood drawn every number of years. But I don't mind being a guinea pig if it furthers science and exert a little effort to protect us all. But, of course, there are a lot of reasons not to trust employers. And here's one example, this from ProPublica. A temp worker died on the job after FedEx didn't fix a known hazard. The fine? $7,000. FedEx workers at the Memphis World Hub said that they were pressured to work faster than they felt safe. The company faces its busiest season ever, but experts worry about safety practices after the extremely preventable death of a temporary worker. Fanny Stanbury had been on the job for 2 months as a package handler at FedEx Express's massive world hub when, towards the end of her overnight shift, packages started to fall from a huge shipping container that rolled past her. As Stanbury, then 61, bent to pick up the packages, she fell and became trapped between the catwalk she'd been standing on and the wheeled platform carrying the shipping containers, also known as a dolly. "I thought I was a goner," Stanbury said. "She broke 8 ribs in her left arm and lacerated her liver," she said. "I had to learn how to walk all over again." FedEx, which is headquartered in Memphis, reported the November 22nd, 2016 incident to the Tennessee Occupational Safety and Health Administration, Tennessee OSHA, the agency charged with protecting workers. Tennessee OSHA asked the shipping giant to investigate itself and suggest corrections, according to state records reviewed by MLK 50, Justice Through Journalism, and ProPublica, and reported here for the first time. FedEx told Tennessee OSHA it would train employees on safe work methods, and the agency declared the company's response sufficient and closed its case. Nearly 3 years later, a strikingly similar incident at the same location claimed the life of Dontate Young, a 23-year-old temporary worker who'd been on the job just shy of a month. Like Stanbury, his job was to unload packages from shipping containers pulled by motorized tugs. A worker closed but didn't lock the vinyl door of a container, a practice that was common. When packages fell against the door, it swung open, hitting Young in the back of the leg. He fell chest first onto a metal pole. The church musician, devoted father, and rapper was pronounced dead at a nearby hospital. This time, Tennessee OSHA did an on-site investigation. It concluded that FedEx was aware from Stanbury's injury of the hazards associated with containers and the equipment ferrying them around, but the company had not done enough to fix the problem. FedEx, whose annual revenues top $75 billion, was fined $7,000 in March for failing to provide a workplace, quote, free from recognized hazards that were causing or likely to cause death or serious physical harm to employees. The penalty was later reduced to $5,950 after FedEx provided Tennessee OSHA with a list of measures it took to prevent similar incidences. Young's death was extremely preventable, said Peter Dooley, a certified industrial hygienist for the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health, which promotes worker safety. The fact that the similar circumstances end up in a fatality several years later just shows how inadequate the investigation and follow-up was into the previous incident. Workers interviewed by ProPublica said they were pressured to work faster than they felt safe, and that the training they received, if any, bore little resemblance to what they actually did on the job. The logistics industry, which plays an essential role in the nation's economy, can be dangerous. Of the major occupational groups, transportation and material moving has the highest number of fatal work injuries and the second highest rate of fatal work injuries, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics 2019 data. The practice of sending a letter to the employer and then waiting for the employer to write back is horrible, said Eric Fruman, Health and Safety Director of Change to Win, a federation of labor unions. He worked as a union labor health and safety expert for more than 40 years and is focused on issues in the South. There's almost no worker involvement in it, and the workers are at the mercy of the relationship between OSHA and the employer. The fixes that FedEx suggested were all focused on training and safety, but it's a mistake to simply focus on training and not the equipment too, said Michael Felsen, a retired U.S. Department of Labor attorney during the Obama and Trump administrations. Employers concerned about safety should also focus on engineering controls, such as modifying the equipment, which do not rely on the workers having to behave in a particular way, but rather they're protected by virtue of the nature of the process, said Felsen, who litigated and supervised worker safety cases for OSHA in the New England region. This is particularly true in the case of temporary workers, he said. The death benefits mandated through the state workers' compensation means that the temporary agency that hired Young will pay the mothers of both sons $97 per week until the boys are adults. But to the people who loved Young, that's not nearly enough, and it's not justice. Justice would be just restructuring FedEx's whole process or setup as far as safety of the employees. Well, folks, an unfortunate reality in our world is it's a lot easier to destroy trust than to build it. So please join me in the long-term process of building trust with one another. This is yet another public health intervention. Okay, well, while the COVID-19 pandemic is a once-in-a-century crisis, it also has a lot of secondary crises that are set up. This from Stat News. Every day is an emergency. The pandemic is worsening psychiatric bed shortages nationwide. The COVID-19 pandemic has dramatically cut the availability of inpatient psychiatric beds, with facilities across the country forced to reduce their capacity to meet social distancing requirements, stem outbreaks of the virus, or repurpose psychiatric beds to care for the surge of COVID-19 patients. The crisis, combined with years of mental health budget cuts, rising demand for mental health care, and an existing shortage of both psychiatric beds and providers, appears to have put healthcare systems on a wartime footing. "Every day is an emergency," said Vincent Caradagas, CEO of Miami-based Banyan Health Systems. "I hate to say it, but our job right now is to normalize a crisis that has been going on for 9 months. Calls to our centers are up 40 to 50%, and our vulnerable behavioral health population has skyrocketed. The pandemic and parallel economic crises have fueled new concerns about access to mental health care. An estimated 40% of American adults have a condition involving mental illness or substance abuse. In June, federal health officials reported nearly 11% of adults surveyed seriously considered suicide during the past 30 days. Patients are a lot sicker and in greater need of intervention since the pandemic began," said Gail Ryder, vice president at Tampa, Florida-based BayCare Behavioral Health. "But finding patients a bed is proving increasingly challenging. Today, there are a third less beds available for psychiatric patients, and if the patient is acting hostile or abusive, it's even more difficult to find a hospital that will take them," he said. "Fewer available behavioral health beds during the pandemic frustrates emergency room staff, who are often asked to care for patients for a prolonged period of time until they can be placed in a more appropriate unit. Right now, we have 4 psychiatric patients boarding at our emergency department for more than 3 days," said Tony Mancuso, an emergency department nurse in Western Massachusetts. "And when a bed does become available, it is sometimes a significant distance from the patient's home, which can prove particularly difficult for pediatric patients. Shipping young people hours away from their family to a hospital bed in another part of the state right now can be difficult," said Wynn of the Massachusetts Health Network. The pandemic has also led some state governments to consider further cuts to mental health care budgets. In September, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy proposed slashing funding for suicide prevention and counseling services. After widespread outcry, the state legislature restored the $15 million program matched by federal funding. In a world deluged with daily updates on soaring COVID cases and deaths, it's difficult to recognize the combined impact of all these political and business decisions working against effective mental health care. Medical experts do not see the arrival of COVID-19 vaccines as a panacea. If people don't have access to treatment when they need it, there can be tragic results at the individual and societal level, said Elizabeth Hank, Research Director of Treatment Advocacy Center. Escalating mental health problems submerged by the pandemic are going to have major long-term effects, Hank said. Right now, many state legislators aren't looking at anything that's not related to this virus. There needs to be better funding as part of the response to COVID. Okay, well, I'd like to close with a story that kind of goes big and ties two seemingly disparate things together in a broad public health way. This from Science Daily. Implementing policies and strategies to eliminate racial disparities could improve outcomes for both COVID-19 and cancer. Income level, employment, housing location, medical insurance, education, tobacco and alcohol use, diet and obesity, access to medical care. These are some of the factors causing worse cancer outcomes in people who are Black. The same factors are also causing worse outcomes from COVID-19 in this population. The similarities between COVID-19 issues and cancer disparities is uncanny, said John Carruthers, John Searle Professor and Chair of Internal Medicine at Michigan Medicine. In cancer, we are seeing in slow motion what has been observed rapidly with COVID, that the same conditions in our society put specific groups at risk for both. If we can fundamentally change socioeconomic inequality, we theoretically could reduce disparities in both diseases, says Carruthers, who is a member of the University of Michigan Cancer Center. Racial disparities in cancer outcomes are well documented, with lower 5-year survival rates for Blacks and whites within most cancer types. With COVID-19, about 20% of the cases in the U.S. have occurred in people who are Black, even though the population represents only 13% of the population. Similarly, Latinos comprise 32% of COVID-19 infections, but are only 17% of the population. On the surface, they seem like very different diseases. Cancer is often caused by genetic defects. COVID-19 is an infectious disease. But the researchers point out issues including socioeconomic disadvantages, education, lifestyle factors, other medical conditions, and limited access to medical care are fueling risks for both cancer and COVID-19 and contributing to worse outcomes. Eliminating the disparities should be a public health imperative, the authors wrote. The major battles for health disparities are insurance coverage, and use of preventive health services that could help eliminate comorbidities such as obesity and diabetes, Carruthers notes. The authors offer several suggestions that would impact both cancer and COVID-19 outcomes. Ensure diversity in clinical trial participants. Support public hospitals to meet the healthcare needs of those that are medically underserved. Improve access technology so all populations can access telehealth services. These strategies are feasible, will take political will, and in some cases, funding. It relies on what people are willing to do to make it work, Carruthers said. We have much to do at all levels. Now, what I really like this story, because it suggests, at least points to, a larger public health approach. I must admit, these authors, when they what they're talking about is basically dealing still from a very medical point of view, you know, changing clinical trial, ways of dealing with it, supporting public hospitals, improving technology so you can do telehealth. Well, if you go back to the beginning of the article, when they talk about the things that are driving both COVID-19 and cancer things with racial disparities, income level, employment, housing location, education. These are not things that are going to be dealt with through the medical system. And this is the very heart of what a public health intervention is when you realize that if you're trying to intervene at the level where the problem is already largely there and can't be beat back, you need to go deeper, have a more radical, widespread solution. So there it is. That's our final lesson for today. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. You can queue up future shows at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Or if you want to like the Facebook page, just search for Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, and like the Facebook page. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.